Hello and welcome to the second episode of the Cinnamon Podcast. I'm David Simmons and this week we will bring you the second talk, which was given by Nick Townsend at the Cinnamon Theology Symposium in Birmingham earlier this month, April 2016. His talk is entitled Catholic Social Teaching, an Introduction and Some Pointers to Rapprochement with Evangelical Christianity. Please note that the papers to which he refers are available to download through the Cinnamon website at cinnamonnetwork.co.uk/podcast. Over to Nick.
Well, good morning. My name's Nick, and yes, there are two handouts coming round. Mark asked me to introduce myself. I was born in New Zealand, and I moved to this country when I was 8. I studied economics and politics, and then I worked in the private sector for a while, including for a while in Birmingham. Then I worked in politics for a few years, and after some postgraduate study, since then I've worked in a number of educational institutions, teaching mature students, people of all ages, from a wide variety of backgrounds, broadly speaking in the areas of Christian ethics and Christianity and politics. I now live in Devon, where I grew up after the age of 8, but for most of the past 10 years I've lived in London and have gone to a small local church, and through that church there's one person here I know who's sitting over there, Stephen Hunt. So nice to see you, Stephen. That's a bit of an introduction to me. In recent years I've done a lot of work on Catholic social teaching for a project based at Newman University here in Birmingham, but I only need to come here relatively infrequently for that project. It's called the Virtual Plato Project, and on one of the handouts in a footnote there is a reference to the website that is for that project. I'll say a little bit more about that later, probably. Can you hear me? Am I loud enough? Okay. I've put on this very old pair of glasses to read my paper, and it's broken. One of the lenses is broken up here somewhere. So if you notice that my glasses are broken, don't be distracted by that. I stood on them some time ago, managed to put them back together, but part of the lens is actually missing. Now, my brief is primarily to introduce Catholic social teaching. Let me just ask you, who here would say that they have some knowledge of Catholic social teaching? That's about six to ten people? So most people would say they don't really know anything about Catholic social teaching. Okay, that's good, because that's what I was told would probably be the case. Now, what I'm going to present is divided into three main parts, and at the end of each part, I'll point to a possible ground for rapprochement, for coming together with between Catholic social teaching and evangelical thought, but that's just a minor aspect of my paper. The main purpose is to seek to set out what Catholic social teaching is. You have two handouts. One of them is headed Modern Catholic Social Teaching, abbreviation CST, Main Vatican Documents. I'll call that the documents handout. And the other one's called Main Principles Articulated in Catholic Social Teaching. I'll call that the Principles handout. If you could look at that one first. Most introductions to Catholic social teaching do present it in terms of a series of documents issued by the Vatican. Most of them are encyclicals, so-called, which are basically long letters that are circulated among the church. On one hand, a set of documents on one hand and a set of principles on the other, and that's the same approach that I'm taking. That's fair enough. That approach, though, can miss the developing theological vision that finds expression in the documents, and in each of the three sections I will try to bring out the underlying theological vision that one can find there. So looking to introduce the paper at the principles handout. At the top of that handout, there's a definition. Something's gone wrong with the copy of the handouts that I have myself. This one, which Mike's just given me, is correct, but that one somehow is not correct. The one that's headed principles should have a list of principles on both sides of it. Is that correct? Okay, for some reason that particular sheet, was not correct. But if most of them are like that, that's great. At the top of that sheet, there's a definition of Roman Catholic social teaching. It is what the Roman Catholic Church has to say, and together with all people of goodwill, as some of the documents put it, to put into practice in relation to the big issues that we face in living together in human societies. Among the issues that Catholic social teaching addresses are work and rest, business, family, poverty, environmental degradation, political participation, what governments should do, peace and war. That's just a definition. In the course of its development, since a particular document issued in 1891 called Rerum Novarum, we'll come on to that in a minute, a number of principles have been articulated which have become central to it. And this handout simply lists these. In one description, the four that are listed on the first side are seen as fundamental: the dignity of the person, the common good, solidarity, and subsidiarity. And if you just look at the second side of the sheet for a moment, those other ones there are also significant in it, some of which from their titles, from the labels of the principle, perhaps are not as easy perhaps to have an intuitive understanding of than some of the earlier ones, such as the universal destination of material goods. Most of these principles I will be referring to in the main part of the presentation, so I'm not going to go through this sheet in detail here, but you might just like to glance down it for a moment. I am, though, going to say a little bit about one of the principles on the first side of the sheet. That is the common good. This is central in Catholic social teaching. It's a very old concept in Christian social thought, going back in different ways to St. Augustine of Hippo, to the New Testament, to the Old Testament, and also in a different way to ancient Greek thought. What does it mean? Well, here's one way into it. The Hebrew term shalom, used many times in the Old Testament, is not far in its meaning from the common good. Both shalom and the common good make the claim that the human good, human fulfillment for us to live well, is found in common. It's found together with others, in relationship with others, in social life. As Jeremiah famously advised the people sent into exile, Jeremiah 29, seek the shalom of the city to which I have exiled you. Pray for it to the Lord, for in its shalom you will have shalom. You could translate that fairly well as, seek the common good of the city to which I have exiled you. Pray for it to the Lord, for in its common good you will find your common good. Now, Catholic social teaching contrasts the eternal common good from the temporal common good. The eternal common good is another way of speaking of the final kingdom of God or reign of God that will come at the end of history, the vision in Revelation 21 of the new heavens and the new earth and new Jerusalem. Relative to this, the temporal common good is a pale imitation, but it refers to the shared good that is possible in human societies now. The crucial point made by this term, as I've already said, is that the human good, human fulfillment for us exists in common, only in common, in relationship, not for individuals as separate atoms. An excellent analogy for this is the music of a choir. If you think about the music of a choir, it is an irreducibly common good. It can't exist for individuals separately. Likewise, the common good exists for us only together. In the shared action, like in the shared action of singing, in the shared action of our lives together in society, we generate the common good and we benefit from it simultaneously. Society, say, the city of Birmingham, should be seen not just as an arena that individuals enter to take something out from it as individuals. Rather, a city like Birmingham is, in its manifold and complex shared activities, it is the locus where its residents, its citizens, by their participation in its life, generate and find their own temporal good, the common good. At least that's how it should be. That's just a few remarks about the common good. It's a central concept in Catholic social teaching, but with a very long history. Indeed, it's a central concept in Christian social thought more broadly. I now want to turn to the other handout. So put the principles handout away and find the handout that's headed, the one about documents. And in what I'm going to say, I'll follow that handout through, though not simply reading from it. Catholic social teaching is articulated in a whole series of documents that have been issued by the Roman Catholic Church, by the Vatican, most of them in the name of the Pope since 1891. And this handout divides those documents into three sets or three trajectories. And I hope this will be a helpful way of introducing them. Let me just get that handout in front of me as well. And the first document issued in 1891 was a response to the Industrial Revolution, which Martin also mentioned, and in particular to the terrible conditions experienced by vast numbers of workers by the late 19th century. Each of the documents, by the way, takes its Latin name from the first words in the document. That's just the way they do it. Rerum Novarum did not mince its words. I quote, "We clearly see that some opportune remedy must be found quickly for the misery and wretchedness pressing so unjustly on the majority of the working class. It has come to pass that working men have been surrendered, isolated and helpless to the hard-heartedness of employers and the greed of unchecked competition. To this must be added that the hiring of labour and the conduct of trade are concentrated in the hands of comparatively few, so that a small number of very rich men have been able to lay upon the teeming masses of the labouring poor a yoke little better than that of slavery." That was Pope Leo XIII in 1891. Interestingly, Rerum Novarum was written 2 years after, I think it was 2 years after the London dock strike, and Cardinal Manning, the then Cardinal Archbishop of Manchester, of Westminster, was one influence on the thinking that ended up being expressed in Rerum Novarum. If there is one brief expression that symbolizes the vision we find in this set of documents, and that first side on the handout takes you through that first trajectory, almost all of the documents there were issued in commemoration of Rerum Novarum. That's why they're all 31, 61, 71, 81, 91, in commemoration of that first one. And John Paul II's document marking the 100th year of Rerum Novarum brought that trajectory to its natural close. If there is one brief expression that symbolizes the vision we find in this set of documents, it's the dignity of work, or to put it slightly more fully, the dignity of the person who is by nature a worker. The fundamental idea here is that work is intrinsic to being human. It is an inherently good part of any fulfilled human life. And from this, some major things follow. And really, the things that were understood to follow from that, as articulated in Rerum Novarum, are the bullet points that I've got at the top of that first side of the handout. Basically, the conditions of work must reflect work's dignity, or the dignity of the people doing it. And it is primarily employers who have a moral duty to make sure that that is the case for those they employ. Interestingly, and quite radically at the time, Rerum Novarum was quite explicit that if employers fail in that duty, it is the role of the state to ensure that the rights of workers are respected, attributing to the state a significant, as it were, interventionist role in relation to the free market economy, which at that time in the late 19th century was very powerfully defended by liberal capitalism. Interestingly too, Rerum Novarum argued that workers should form associations or unions to defend their claims for justice, but equally interestingly, Catholic social teaching from that point onwards said that such unions should be explicitly Christian organisations and definitely not socialist organisations, because Rerum Novarum explicitly rejected socialism as the solution to the problem of the condition of labour. And throughout the tradition of Catholic social teaching, there has been both the rejection of socialism and a trenchant critique of liberal capitalism, an articulation of a position that is neither of those. Now, that reflects the way that Catholic social teaching has always rejected any mechanistic vision. What I mean by that is, whereas liberal capitalism basically says, have markets as free as you can and things are going to be fine, as though that's a mechanistic conclusion to the method you're following, whereas that's what liberal capitalism says, whereas traditionally socialism says move to common ownership or social ownership, usually state ownership, and that will solve the problems. Catholic social teaching has rejected any kind of mechanistic solution. Rather, it's articulated increasingly the importance of solidarity, which basically means we have to be committed in all the areas of life to working for justice with one another and for one another, and that's the only way we're going to achieve it. It is kind of up to us. There is no easy mechanistic solution to the sorts of problems that CST was addressing. Now, the full biblical and theological rationale for the vision in this trajectory of documents wasn't articulated really until John Paul II's 1981 document, Laborem Exercens, all about human work. And I think this is incredibly interesting. And so this brings out the sort of underlying vision more fully that there is in this trajectory. Human beings, as creatures made in the image of God, and he gives some exposition of the early chapters of Genesis in that document, are given responsibility for dominion within God's good creation, which is to say for stewardship. As he put this point later in a different text, the human creature receives a mission to govern creation in order to make all its potential shine. And he says the main way we fulfill this is human work. Quotes, work is the means whereby man achieves that dominion which is proper to him. In other words, it's through work, which he defines very broadly to include the domestic sector, the private sector, the public sector, the third sector. It's through work that we fulfill the fundamental purpose for which God has created us and put us on earth. And so that is quite a big vision. It has huge implications for how work is seen and done. It does make it critically important that the conditions in which people work and the work they actually do are such as are enabling them to participate in the God-given task of exercising dominion and making all of creation's potential shine. And in this way, work comes to be fulfilling of our humanity. Now, this first strand, this first trajectory of Catholic social teaching, for a long time, this was Catholic social teaching. This was it. And in quite a bit of writing about Catholic social teaching, in a way, it's still this that is being referred to first and foremost as what Catholic social teaching is, this body of documents addressing that set of issues. I just want, before moving on, to refer to a point of rapprochement with evangelical thought, I think, in quite a lot of recent interpretations of what it is that we are made in the image of God. There is a recognition, an understanding that that's to do with the role God gives us within creation of exercising dominion within God's good creation, a responsibility given to us to take care of it and bring out its potential. Could refer to a few writers there, but I'll pass over that. I think there's a point of rapprochement there. That's the end of the first trajectory. The second trajectory, if you turn over the handout to the second page, the so-called Catholic human rights revolution. Here's a quote from a 2004 statement. The Church sees in men and women, in every person, the living image of God himself. This image finds and must always find anew an ever deeper and fuller unfolding of itself in the mystery of Christ, the perfect image of God, the one who reveals God to man and man to himself. It is to these men and women who have received an incomparable and inalienable dignity from God himself that the church speaks, constantly reminding them of their lofty vocation. There is a strong emphasis on human dignity in Catholic social thought, as the first trajectory has already brought out. But in the 1960s, that led to what can be seen as a revolution in Catholic understanding of the acceptability of talking about human rights. During the 19th century, following the French Revolution, the Catholic Church had set itself against what the French Revolution stood for with its doctrine of the rights of man, seeing it as a kind of declaration of independence of God. But in the 19th century, the Catholic Church, in a sense, overcame that suspicion by finding deep within its theology and its way of seeing the world a way of articulating an understanding of human rights that was consistent with its traditional theology. The documents in which that revolution is articulated are the three that are from the 1960s on the handout. And the first one, Pacem in Terris, is really the main one in which that is effected. Interestingly, in that document, there is a complete running together of freedom rights, basic civil liberties, and economic rights. They are not nicely or neatly separated. The Church's social teaching strongly affirms both. And that in the context was controversial in a sense, because people on the political right tend to be sceptical about economic and social rights, whereas people on the political left think that they're the really important ones and the basic civil liberties are less important. But in the way the Catholic Church affirmed human rights, it affirmed both. That so-called revolution, I'm referring to one particular scholar who's called it the Catholic Human Rights Revolution, was completed in Dignitatis Humanae of 1965, because in that document, which was the most controversial of the several documents that came out of the Second Vatican Council, the meeting of all the world's Catholic bishops in the early 1960s, Dignitatis Humanae affirms that there is a human right to religious freedom. And that seemed to go against, indeed, on the face of it, did go against what the Catholic Church had always taught prior to that. It did not recognize that there is a human right to religious freedom, but now it does in a formal way. I won't go into the details of that here for reasons of time, but just refer, if you look over the page to the bottom of the third page of the handout, there's a reference to John Paul II's encyclical Evangelium Vitae, the Gospel of Life, in 1995. I've put this on the handout under the heading of Outliers, major documents in Catholic social teaching that don't fit within one of the three trajectories. But having prepared the handout, I did think that it might be appropriate, indeed it probably is appropriate, to locate Evangelium Vitae within the second trajectory. And notice that it was published in a year that has five at the end, and so fits with three of the other documents that I've placed in that trajectory. And what's happening in that document of 1995, which focuses most prominently on abortion and euthanasia, is that the Pope John Paul II is articulating some reasons why the Catholic Church had come to have big concerns about the direction that liberal democracies had started to go in since the 1960s. The time when Catholic social teaching more or less came to affirm a lot that liberal democracies also affirm. Over the subsequent decades, the Catholic Church had found reasons for, in a sense, holding back a bit and being a little bit more sanguine about that affirmation. It's a powerful document, and in particular, it emphasizes the importance of the inherent connection of freedom and truth, and the vital importance of recognizing this in democracies, and critiques the increasing tendency, as Pope John Paul saw it, and as Benedict XVI, who followed him, also saw it, for democracies to sort of depend on relativism as a sort of basis. I quote, "Democracy cannot be idolized to the point of making it a substitute for morality. It is urgently necessary for the future of human society and the development of a sound democracy to rediscover those essential and innate human and moral values which flow from the very truth of the human being and express and safeguard the dignity of the person, values which no individual, no majority, and no state can ever create, modify, or destroy, but must only acknowledge, respect, and promote." And there's a pointer, okay, there's a pointer to another rapprochement here, I think, with evangelical thought, because of evangelical thought's traditional, very strong emphasis on holding to the truth, not giving in to, quote, every wind of doctrine, Ephesians 4:14. That's the second trajectory. Moving on quickly to the third trajectory. Begins in 1967, where Roman Catholic social teaching turns its attention to international development and the problem of global poverty. And this third trajectory, which starts at the bottom of the third page of your handout, bottom of the second page of your handout, goes on to the third. There are really three documents in this trajectory. 1967, 1987, which marked the 20th anniversary of 1967, and then 2009, which in principle marked the 40th anniversary, but it came out 2 years late, and that was largely because of the financial crisis to which this document gives a profound response that reached its pitch in 2008. And the fundamental idea in this third trajectory, which is in critique of conceptions of development that are narrowly economic, the fundamental idea is captured in the phrase integral human development. I quote from Populorum Progressio, that's 1967, "Development cannot be limited to mere economic growth. In order to be authentic, it must be complete, integral. That is, it has to promote the good of every person and the whole person. That is, the person in every dimension of his or her humanness." And that idea of integral human development has been articulated more fully in that trajectory. And in order to just briefly summarize the rest of this third trajectory, I'll just draw attention to two main points and focus on the second of them. The first way in which this trajectory came to be developed was an articulation of that it can be correct and true to speak in terms of sinful or unjust social structures. And John Paul II articulated that concept partly under the influence of a number of strands in his 1987 document that's referred to there. Then the second point to which I want to draw attention is the most substantial one here, and one that's really worth being aware of. And this in particular is in Caritatis in Veritate of 2009. The concept of integral human development has been articulated in an increasingly theological way, and indeed one that is connected inherently with the gospel and Christian mission. That encyclical 2009 begins, "Charity in truth," that means the practice of charity in truth, "to which Jesus Christ bore witness by his early life, is the principal driving force behind the authentic development of every person and of all humanity. Love, caritas, is an extraordinary force which leads people to opt for courageous and generous engagement in the field of justice and peace. It is a force that has its origin in God, eternal love, and absolute truth." And it goes on to emphasize the way that the practice of charity, and he means by that all pretty much all forms of social engagement that we might have, is, I quote, "love is based on and expresses," quote, "love received and given." Love received and given. That is, those Christians who engage in it are conscious of already having received love, the love of God, and it is only in that context that they can give. I quote, "It is grace. Its source is the wellspring of the Father's love for the Son in the Holy Spirit. Love comes down to us from the Son. It is creative love through which we have our being. It is redemptive love through which we are recreated. Love is revealed and made present by Christ and, quote, poured into our hearts through the Holy Spirit, Romans 5:5. I continue to quote, as the object of God's love, men and women become subjects of charity, those who do charity. They are called to make themselves instruments of grace so as to pour forth God's charity and to weave networks of charity. And this dynamic of charity received and given gives rise to the church's social teaching. And I think and I could go on with one or two other quotes, but I think there, in that very extraordinary document, there is an obvious basis for a rapprochement with evangelical social thought because of the very, you know, unmistakable emphasis on the primacy of God's grace and our dependence on that for anything that we might try to do in society. So to conclude, in these three trajectories, we see almost the whole of modern Catholic social teaching. The one document I haven't placed under any of those headings or referred to is the most recent, which is Francis's Laudato Si of last year on care for the common home. And we could maybe say something about that in questions, but I'll just pass over that for now. I think it does fit against that background. I better just stop there. I was going to say a little bit about where I stand in relation to all this. I'm not a Roman Catholic. My background is in evangelical Christianity, and my main theological convictions accord with that. And when I first encountered CST, I brought characteristic Protestant and evangelical skepticism to it. When I read the first of these documents that I read, I just thought it was absolutely outstanding. And since then, I've had opportunities to learn a lot more about it. I'd better stop. Thank you.
That was Nick Townsend. Stay with us as we podcast the final talk next week. For more information about Cinnamon Network, our purpose, our recognised projects and our microgrants, head to www.cinnamonnetwork.co.uk. You can follow us on Twitter, @Cinnamon Network. You can like us on Facebook, and you can subscribe to our weekly emails. Simply head to our homepage and click on Get News by Mail. Thank you for listening.